Chapter 2. Sedimentary. Do you know that sludge left in the bottom of the glass after you finish an old bottle of Burgundy? This is wine sediment, the slurry of the wine that fell to the bottom. This is the way sedimentary rock has formed, but under the complications of pressure and time. The slurry from bodies of water, ranging from creeks to oceans, compressed over eons, turns into sedimentary rock. This category includes all sorts of fun things, from sooty coal to mystical amber. But when it comes to the dirt that suits the vine, it is the dark shale, the lively limestone, the desert-evoking sandstone, the durable flint, silex, and the magical diatomite that fascinate. Textures are also important, and they too fall under the rubric of sedimentary soil. These include the galet rocks of Chateauneuf-du-Pape and Rioja, as well as the petite gravels of Bordeaux, Napa, and New Zealand. And then there's the less of Austria and California. The category is tremendously diverse. Sandstone. Most sandstone is composed of quartz and or feldspar. These are the most common minerals in the Earth's crust. Like sand, sandstone comes in many shades. The color depends on the mineral content. The most prevalent hues are tan, brown, yellow, red, gray, pink, white, and black. Sandstone beds often form highly visible cliffs and other topographical features. The notable sandstone regions are parts of Alsace, Piemonte, Chianti, and the eastern parts of the country of Georgia. Silex. When quartz-like silicon dioxide goes through not compression but chemical changes, it emerges into a metal-like hardness called silex, more commonly known as flint or chert. This stone gave mankind our first sharp blades for slicing and hunting. It's an incredibly hard rock that, when smashed, fragments into painfully sharp edges. It forms when caught up in limestone or chalk, and that is why it exists almost exclusively where limestone is found. But there are a few vineyard spots in the world where its presence is profound. The notable flinty wine regions are in the Loire and especially certain terroirs in Sancerre and Touraine. Shale. Like slate, shale is dark and layered, but this most common type of sedimentary rock did not go through the heat of metamorphism, only the pressure. And so this is a sedimentary compressed mud with a bit of quartz and other minerals. Notable regions include Montalcino, parts of Tuscany where it's called Galestro, the Finger Lakes in New York, part of the Swartland around Malmesbury in South Africa, and parts of Santa Barbara, California. Diatomite. Never heard of diatomite? Of course you have, but probably by another name, diatomaceous earth. It's everywhere in our life, from cat litter to water filtration to toothpaste. This soft rock is made of compressed diatoms and the fossils of algae and other creatures. White as chalk, but without any carbonite calcium content, it is almost pure silica with very little organic matter. While it is quite rare, you can find some in California, both in Santa Barbara and in the Santa Rita Hills near Lompoc. Limestone. This sedimentary soil formed from ancient seabeds and coral reefs and has given birth to such revered and profound wine regions that sometimes I think Neptune not only rules over the sea but also over the vine. Pascaline and I could write 3 books about the limestone regions that make great wine, so compressing it is a challenge. But, nevertheless, at the top of the heap, the sediments that bring winemakers and drinkers to their knees are the white and yellow, chalky, porous, sponge-like limestone. There are some evangelists who consider this the high emperor of rocks. Limestone. There are many uses for this sedimentary rock, ranging from flooring to scrubbing an amphora, but it's so intrinsically linked to great wine that I had to laugh when I once read this definition of limestone. A hard sedimentary rock, composed mainly of calcium carbonate or dolomite, used as building material and in the making of cement. Technically, limestone is merely a rock, one made of the minerals calcite and aragonite, but spiritually, ooh la la. To some, it's the holiest vine soil going. It is associated with elegance. Limestone is something that you first sense up front in the mouth, on the tip of the tongue, and it betokens a long finish with a linear structure. From dense limestone to chalk, these soils formed from the decomposed bodies of all kinds of creatures, from mollusks to fishes to coral. The most notable limestone soils are the brilliant white, chalky, complicated with plenty of diatomite albariza in Spain's Jerez region, yellow and white tufo in the Loire, the gray and white chalk in Champagne, and the limestone in Burgundy. Limestone, in its purest state, is white or almost white. But like a white dress where every stain is easily noticed, the elements that mix with the limestone cause many limestones to sport different hues, especially on weathered soils. According to Tablas Creek, a California winery that went out of its way to locate and plant on limestone in the Golden State, there is increasing evidence that calcium-rich soils help maintain acidity in grapes late in the growing season, as long as what's planted there are the right grapes. Calcium also is purported to strengthen the grape against certain diseases. These are fantastic bonuses, but the real benefit lies in the soil's water retention capabilities, especially where people dry farm. Water is necessary for the essential processes by which plants take up nutrients through their roots. Grapevines don't do well in waterlogged soils, which increase the likelihood of root disease. But with calcium-rich soil, the soils can hold the water, allowing the vine to drink instead of sitting in a pool of water, permitting the soil to retain moisture in periods of dry weather, but allowing for good drainage during heavy rains. However, there are many variables that must be taken into consideration, such as slope and the percentage of clay minerals in the soil and whether there's a depression in the earth where the water pools, or a cold spot, a hot wind, or a dry wind. But even with the extra factors, for many, limestone is the holy grail. Soil scientists Claude and Lydia Bourguignon are limestone fanatics. I saw them speak several times, but the most memorable instance was in Switzerland, where Claude was quite the vision with cowboy boots, flashing silver rings, and all around looking decidedly un-Burgundian, as he pronounced that 7% of the Earth's geology is limestone. 55% of that is in Burgundy. His figures have been debated by at least one notable geologist, but nevertheless, speaking in machine-gun-fast English, Bourguignon describes the layout of Burgundy and the properties of different areas that gave rise to distinct traditions. In Burgundy, the cooler and higher elevation is in the Côte de Nuit and is more suitable for reds. The Côte de Beaune is warmer and for some reason more suitable for whites. The monks knew what they were doing as they made their decisions based on the quality of the soil, the quality of the mineral limestone content of the clay. Bourguignon said there were really only two types of wines of technology and wines of terroir. When it comes to the terroir, the land aspect, he said, should trump climate. Climate will change over time, for sure, but year to year, the soil is more constant. The natural approach, with the least intervention you can get away with, is the only path to express terroir, he argued. He and I might disagree on the supremacy of limestone, but we do agree on farming methods. Natural practices make for a more active root system and a livelier soil where the nutrients from the ground, in all of their peculiarities, are more accessible to the plant. Of course, and his last name has nothing to do with it, the best place for that soil is none other than Burgundy, France. Burgundy. The first time I visited the Holy Land of Burgundy, I rode in on horseback. Okay, that's a lie. I rode the train from Paris and arrived on a raw November day when the vines were bare. On solid ground in the town of Beaune, I felt quivery, starstruck. I'm not alone in this reaction. People often kneel and kiss the soil upon their first visit. They take pictures at the vineyards. They steal grapes and leaves and rocks as souvenirs. The vines are tormented by paparazzi. People have even held them hostage, so valuable are they. I have never been one for hero worship, but I was touched by the land's heritage and what it stood for. In modern times, the whole debate over terroir and matters of place started here. The Romans first put down the vines in Burgundy, but it was the Cistercians who brought it to high art. In 775 CE, King Charlemagne put the land in the monks' stewardship, and over the next 1,000 years, the holy men plotted and assessed the land, tasting the soil along the way to perceive the differences. They developed a system of vineyard designation that became the gold standard around the world, distinguishing hundreds of plots they call climat. With Burgundy's subtle soil differences that change every few inches, every collector in the world will swear to you that they know how to blind taste a Vaune against a Volnay and a Charme from a Chambertin. What makes one plot of land different from the other? The dirt. To understand what makes Burgundy soil so revered, time travel is needed, back to when the future famed region was a hot and humid land located near the Earth's equator. The sea soon swallowed the tropical mass whole when tectonic plates shifted. It was about 200 million years ago, during the Jurassic period, when seashells and the remains of algae, fish, corals, and other organisms living in the tropical waters sank to the sea bottom. Over millions of years, their sediments created layers upon layers. Each layer had a different chemistry and a different texture. Pascaline thinks of this as a millefeuille pastry where some layers are harder and some are soggier. A mere 140 million years later, the land was spit out from the water, only to discover the earth was still in a tropical haze. The foundation of limestone was forming, but the land was not finished. First, the Alps had to be born. The peaks were born through the movement of plates, and from there commenced a series of bending and fracturing throughout the land. The Jura and Burgundy split from each other, creating the Sun Fault, and lo and behold, up came this great and eventually famous limestone slope with its variation of climat. Not all of Burgundy is that perfect mix of limestone and clay, argilo-calcaire. In fact, it is only in the Côte d'Or where that sublime, elastic kind of combination exists. Burgundy's heart is the Côte d'Or, the slope of gold, a 35-mile stretch winding down south from Dijon. There are two lobes to that holy land, the Côte de Nuit, most famed for red, and the Côte de Beaune, famed for white. The road that runs through it from Dijon to Mérange was the long-celebrated RN74. Post-EU, it is called the D974. What hasn't changed is that it is built on the fault that divides the great terroir from the common. To the east, on the side of the railroad tracks, there's much more clay and less limestone, and it is too fertile and flat for great wine. That's where they grow wines called Pastugrain, Pinot and Gamay, Bourgogne à la Gotte, and some basic Bourgogne red and white. There's not much of it, and if you wander, you'll soon be outside of vineyards into fields of cattle and grain. The foundation for the great wines is toward the sunset and the cliffs, and on the slopes it is the middle section, the interior of a sandwich, so to speak, where the choicest spots lie. Thank you, medieval Cistercian monks, for figuring that out. Those familiar with the huge vineyards of the New World would view Burgundy's crazy quilt patchwork of vines as quaint and insignificant. There are no huge vineyards here, but rather an endless stretch of small plots, the result of Napoleonic laws of inheritance. Most have many owners, sometimes with claimants even dividing rows within a vineyard. Then there are the rare exceptions, called monopoles. One vineyard, one owner, such as Frédéric Mounier's Clos de Maréchal in Neuilly-Saint-Georges and Domaine de la Romanée-Conti's La Tache and Romanée-Conti. When last counted, the Côte d'Or had 32 Grand Cru, a designation reserved for the finest and the most expensive wines, and more than 460 Premier Cru, the next step down. The slope is divided into two sections. The southern side is the Côte de Beaune, which hugs the city of Beaune and stretches from Ladoix-Serigny to Mérange. Then there's the more northern Côte de Nuit, which centers around the village of Neuilly-Saint-Georges and stretches south to Corgaux-Louin and north to Marcenais. While their weather is similar, there are differences mostly in the clay mineral content, which is heavier in the north, making it more suitable for red grapes. The slopes are softer in Beaune, and there are more different kinds of microclimates and open valleys, which might be the reason that the Côte de Beaune is far more susceptible to damaging summer hails. Burgundy's hierarchy of wine labels. At the top are the 33 Grand Cru. This includes one in Chablis. Beneath them are the 570 Premier Cru, including more than 460 in the Côte d'Or. In the next step down, the bottle will sport a generic village name like Choré-les-Bons with no sign of Grand Cru or Premier Cru on the label. Then there are generic Côte de Beaune or Côte de Nuit labels from grapes within the district or subregions. At the very bottom are the basic Burgundy labels. In this group are also Bourgognon Pastugrain, which is Gamay and Pinot, and Bourgognon Aligoté. Grapes can come from Chablis and Masson and be blended. The grapes. Burgundy's Côte d'Or is known for being a two-grape town, Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. Well, that's almost true. Back in the old Roman days, there was a multitude of grapes, including the mother of them all, Gouet Blanc. But we believe that it was the vine-tending monks who started to select and focus the breeding, and now there's just a handful of varieties. The two major ones are those you really need to know for Wine 101, Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. For extra credit, listen on. Pinot Noir. Burgundy has always been the most sublime expression of the neurotic Pinot Noir grape. Early budding makes this one a real loser if there's a freak frost. In rain and humidity, it's prone to rot. Thin-skinned, it splits easily, gets burnt, and remains pale in the glass. But when it all works, the world celebrates. Soils matter to this nervous vine, and it does love limestone. In Burgundy's long, cool growing seasons, the vine brings forth pretty berry-like fruits, aromas of raspberry and red currants, and rosiness like that of Chanel No. 5 emerge. Other spots in France, the Loire, Jura, Alsace, Champagne, do beautifully with the grape, often on limestone as well. Want Pinot in other climes and soils? Pfalz, in Germany, has both limestone and basalt. In California, look to the shale of Santa Cruz and the diatomaceous soils of Lompoc or on the loam of Sonoma. But in those sunny climates, especially when the soils are rich with loam, be prepared for a fruit bomb. Oregon's weather is a bit kinder to Pinot, but when the soil is volcanic, and note there are other soils there, such as sedimentary rock-based and others from flood deposits, the expression is less jam and more of an extreme sweetness of fruit. Gamay. Poor Gamay, banished from the best slopes to the heavy clay, allowed only to be mixed in with Pinot Noir for Pastugrain, or to be bottled all by itself in the Haute Côte, where they can be structured and refined. Go back and learn all about it in the Beaujolais section, in the Granite section of Chapter 1. Chardonnay. In the 90s, "I'll have your Chardonnay" became code for "white wine, please." And most of the world forgot that it was Burgundy that made some of the world's most famous white wines like Montrachet and Cassagne Montrachet. Soon, they were growing it everywhere, even in Rioja and Piemonte. It was ludicrous. But Chardonnay is easy to grow, and because it's actually relatively neutral, you can put it in tons of makeup and dress it up any way you like. Ah, but to make it without tricks. Then you are left with a grape that can expose your farming ability. Left to its own devices, Chardonnay has very little aroma and tends to be a generous mouthfeel. It can be refreshing, tending toward lemony in cool climates and going tropical in the heat. There are some interesting clones. One is the rosy-colored grape Chardonnay Rose. It's worth seeking out. This is another limestone-loving grape, with the world's finest examples coming from the Jura and Champagne. But on granite, it also manages to become less fleshy and more stately. Aligoté. Not the vine for those who need immediate gratification. A vine has to be at least 15 years old before it gives anything good, but when it does, it sure does. It's a cousin of Chardonnay and has been abused, just as Gamay was, banished to the wrong side of the tracks. It tends to give a tart white wine. If you farm pitifully, you'll get an anemic, scratchy wine with screaming acidity, and that's how Aligoté became infamous for being the base for Kir, the wine mixed with creme de cassis. But give it low yields, organic farming, and the best limestone and clay marls Burgundy has to offer, and then this ugly duckling of a grape can take on the best. In fact, it was completely regal on a Grand Cru, the Hill of Corton, up until 1972. With Jean-Charles Le Beau de la Morinière, I had a 40-year-old stunner. Laurent Ponceau had made a very big point by making a premiere crew allégote with his Le Mans Louisant, teaching us the lesson that it's the place that can bring out the best in a grape. Allégote is not grown too many other places in the world. In Burgundy, it has to have the grape name on the label, and it's called Bourguignon Allégote, even if it comes from century-old vines in Chablis, as with Alice A. Olivier de Moore. It has its own appellation, Bouzeron, located not in the fancy Côte d'Or, but in the more plebeian Côte Chalonnaise. There's a little bit of it grown in the country of Georgia, on limestone soils in Switzerland, and there are also a few vines in California, from Josh Jensen's Calera. Other grapes commonly found in Burgundy are Pinot Gris, Pinot Barreau, Sauvignon Blanc, and Césaire, which is a rustic red grape only allowed in the north, in Yonne. You'll never find them as single varieties, except under the Vin de France label, and up in Auxerre, near Chablis. That's where Saint-Brie is an original appellation dedicated to Sauvignon Blanc. Winemaker Profile, Domaine Bizeau, Côte de Nuit. I waited near the church in the hallowed village of Vaune-Romanée. This is the same village where Domaine de la Romanée-Conti exists, along with so many other famous names. This was the village with the most wine paparazzi and the most revered appellations of them all. An acre of land goes for well over $1 million, though it never comes on the market. If you inherit land, like Jean-Yves Bizeau did, that's the best way to get into this hallowed ground. Sighting Bizeau, I waved to him and walked to greet the vigneron. He was tall and lanky, like an overgrown Harry Potter. "The vines?" I asked eagerly. Bizeau had a patch right near his home, and we stepped in for a peek. It had been a very wet year, and it was nearing harvest time. He pulled back a stray vine and tucked it around a wire with an audible grunt. "Can you tell how fed up I am with them this year?" We were just west of the road that used to be the RN-74 in Les Jachis, a village-level vineyard. Our plan was to visit, taste, and have dinner with him and like-minded vigneron Claire Naudin at their home in Vaune. But first, a moment of silence. All around us, in his and other vineyards, were the signs of the 2012 Burgundian summer of 10 plagues. Cold, hot, hail, rain, mildew, rot, frogs, slime, boils, more rot. It was hell if you worked organically, which is Bizeau's way, though his vines are not certified. Bizeau originally studied geology, but when no one in his family wanted to take over the family vines, he stepped in. The year was 1993, and his first vintage was in 1995. "I had to unlearn everything I was taught in the Lycée Viticole," he said to me when I first met him, over eggplant curry in his kitchen. He said his transformation to minimalist winemaker started slowly. I asked myself what was absolutely necessary to make wine. He began to strip the tools and ingredients away, one by one. He found out the only thing he needed was a container to hold the grapes, his feet for stomping, and barrels to put the wine in. Along the way, he realized that he couldn't tolerate sulfur. He reduced his usage until there was sometimes none at all. "Do you know there was very little sulfur used before the 70s in Burgundy?" he asked me. Bizeau's first vintage without sulfur came in 1998. Besides the lid sulfur puts on the wine, he speculates that it also increases extraction. "And you know that black currant in Pinot?" he asked. He said that comes from Mère Captain, a wine flaw usually characterized by a cabbage-like smell. And yes, he also attributes that to the effect sulfur can have on a wine. He raises his wines, no matter from which soils, in 100% new oak, a choice which scared me. His reasoning is that with new oak, he can avoid sulfuring barrels before usage. My first wine of his, over that eggplant, was a 2007 Haute Côte White. I found it overpowered by the vanilla of wood, but still, there was an intriguing wine beneath. It was impossible to be indifferent about it. The Domaine is barely more than a postage stamp. Bizeau started out with 2.5 hectares split among fragmented parcels in Vaune and Flagey-es-Chézeaux. He recently added an extra hectare in 3 parcels of old vine acquisitions, south of Dijon, Bourguignon-le-Capitre, and Marsenay-Clou-du-Roi. Down through a blue door, into a typical shallow ancient cellar weeping moisture, we tasted a few of his 2011s. Even in their infancy, depending on the terroir, they handled the oak differently. The Marsannay Clos d'Auvergne, from a dry and hot terroir, had the hardest time integrating the oak. I was deeply impressed, however, by the cooler parcels. The Vonlay Jachise, the parcel he was peeved with earlier in the evening, had such vibrancy. The Eschezot Grand Cru was more angular. Much is made of Bizot's having lived down the block from the late godlike winemaker Henri Jaillet, a relationship that was formally deified in The Drops of God, a famous Japanese manga. It's practically apocryphal. Writers have spread it around that Jaillet was Jean-Yves' mentor. Robert Parker's ex-Burgundy critic, Pierre-Antoine Rovani, was responsible for much of this. I asked what the truth was. I said to Pierre-Antoine, many years ago now, that I learned more about wine speaking with Jaillet in 3 hours than in 2 years of studying enology, Bizot said. He somehow concluded I was a disciple of Jaillet. I think it's a little bit short-sighted. My home is less than 100 meters up from his house. We sometimes discussed wines. He believes Jaillet had a lot to teach him about how the job doesn't stop when the wine is made, that marketing is important. But he continued, "Our ways to make wine are quite opposite. Consider their positions on the stems. Bizot uses 100% of the stems, while Jaillet destemmed, or on cold maceration. Bizot uses none, while it was Jaillet's calling card. But the main lesson, and the most important, I received from him is to free myself from the common and usual rules to make wine." In his era, he imagined another solution, completely different from what other producers were doing. So, in this meaning, yes, I agree. I am a disciple of Jaillet. We find our own solutions to problems. Even with the star status bestowed on him by The Drops of God, Bizot doesn't get a lot of press. This might be due to his breathtaking prices, but is he an interesting man? Absolutely. Should you buy his wines if you have the money and the curiosity? Absolutely. Anyway, I'm a sucker for 100% stem vinification. Remember to give it some age. Give that oak a chance to meld and the stems to do their magic trick. You don't have to wait for your grandchildren's college graduation to open it, but 10 years should pay you back royally. Winemaker Profile, Bernard Van Berg, Côte de Beaune. High above nowhere lies some land not far from Merceau, where only a crazy person would plant vines. Here, that crazy person is Bernard Van Berg. His first priority was to acquire a piece of Burgundy in a rural place, in a natural place. After that, he was convinced he would respect the land and the land would respect the wine. His parents, Dutch by origin, were vacationing in France when World War II broke out. The couple managed to get to Switzerland and remained there in safety. They then moved to Brussels, where Van Berg was raised. He claims to have discovered his passion for wine when he was 5 years old. Left in the dinner room while the men went to smoke, he drained the wine remaining in the glasses, then went to ask his father, "Papa, why is the room spinning?" By the time he was 18, he had graduated to knocking on the door of Domaine de la Romanée Conti. It was expensive, but at 20 euros or so at the time, not so bad. Years later, past 50, and ready to indulge a growing desire to make wine, he gave up photography and moved with his wife Judith to Merceau in 2001, putting out his first vintage in 2002. Then he set out to find his own way of making wine, having no idea there was such a thing as natural winemaking. When I visited, it had started to storm and he handed me an umbrella. We drove to a corner of Merceau I never knew existed, far away from the Grand Cru. There, on 2 hectares of forgotten land, allocated to ordinary wine, Pinot, Gamay, Chardonnay, and Aligoté, that Van Berg has brought a sense of grace. Van Berg has made some startling decisions, such as training some of his Chardonnay and Gamay in that beanpole trellising, Echelat, as on the steep slopes of the northern Rhone and unseen anywhere else in Burgundy. He chose his plots far away from the intensive farming in the fancy part of Burgundy. For him, it was essential to find a rural spot filled with life and biodiversity. He purchased 4 hectares while only working 2, ensuring enough natural land to support his vision. From the very beginning, he was out to prove that there were historical plots ignored by the authorities that mapped the lands of Burgundy. He believed that these neglected patches would produce spectacular wines if one used uncompromising discipline. Working on instinct, he uses organic and herbal teas for farming. Some vineyard soils are worked by horse, others plowed by hand. Some, like the one plot of Chardonnay vines, have not been tilled in 6 years. As an artist, it makes sense that Van Berg works on instinct, but it is rare that a vineyard is such a natural extension of a person. Bernard won't eat meat, his wife Judith told me, because he doesn't want to kill animals, and he often escorts insects off the roads or returns frogs to the pond so they won't be killed. I could easily envision the vigneron focusing on a plant to sense what it wanted. Did it desire the bondage of Cordon? Did it want the freedom and stretch of Echallah? The goal is that the vine, as well as the winemakers, have positive energies, Judith explained. On that day, I was quickly starting to resemble a drowned rat, and the gentleman took pity on my soaking paws. We retreated into the shelter, and he took me on a quick walk through the couverie. I cast about looking for clues. He uses a vertical press so tiny it is almost toy-like. He has 100% new wood barrels for his élevage, except for an orange wine he once made. He always uses stems, whole cluster, and foot-treading. The red wines never have sulfur, but the white wines have very small amounts. His Danish importer asked him to give up even that little bit of SO2, but he clings to it. When the laws changed in 2012 and Vin de France allowed the vintage to be posted on the bottle, he opted out of Bourgognon Grand Ordinaire. BGO is now obsolete, and this was replaced by the perceived more marketable Coteau Bourguignon appellation. To make his point, he opted for Bordeaux-style bottles. After tasting the wines, I had no idea how he ever won the classification, as they could dramatically challenge the conventional notion of wine from the Côte d'Or. Finally, we sat down to taste. The wines are delicate in every way, except the prices, which are breathtakingly expensive and a perfect counterpoint to an issue on value. After all, how could you place a value on these wines? Van Berg rarely makes more than 2,000 bottles, which sounds a lot larger than the actual 168 cases in total. Does that make him the tiniest commercial winery in Burgundy? I know for sure he's about the most eccentric. Newsflash. The rare wine he makes is slated to become rarer, as bowing to the devastating frost and hail that wiped out his crop in 2016, he has made the painful decision to try to sell off most of his land to someone who will continue in his philosophy. I wish him a soulful buyer, but I mourn the loss. Burgundy needs outliers like Van Berg. How not to lose your shirt drinking Burgundy. In coming years, we will have a tremendous drop in Burgundy availability, as there have been an inordinate number of low and almost no-yield vintages of late due to dramatic weather and loss from hail. This means that an expensive wine will be rarer and indeed more expensive. But that shouldn't mean you have to do without. There are a few wines that everyone seems to want, and even when Burgundy prices go nuts, some others, even great producers such as Jean-Claude Rateau, can't seem to get enough attention. So do what you do in the best of worlds, even if there were wines aplenty. Buy a great producer's cheapest wines. Look for wines in the outer boroughs. Look for brand new producers before they get too hot. Many on the following list fall into this category. Who to drink? Domaine Berthaud, Figson, in conversion to organic. Sylvain Patay, Marsenay, biodynamic. Jean-Louis Trappé, Gevrey Chambertin, biodynamic. Jane A. Sylvain, Gevrey Chambertin, organic. Domaine Bellerin, Moret Saint-Denis, biodynamic. Domaine Arlot, Moret Saint-Denis, biodynamic. Domaine de la Romanée Conti, Von Romanée, biodynamic. Bruno Chevalier, Von Romanée, biodynamic. Jean-Yves Bizot, Von Romanée, organic. Nicolas Faure, Nuit Saint-Georges, organic. Domaine Prieuré Roque, Nuit Saint-Georges, biodynamic. Jacques-Frédéric Mounier, Chambolly, Musigny, sustainable. Chandon de Briaille, Savigny-les-Bons, dynamic. François de Nicolet, Savigny-les-Bons, organic. Maison Arbre, Savigny-les-Bons, organic. Chantreve, Savigny-les-Bons, sustainable, organic. Domaine Simon Bise, Savigny-les-Bons, biodynamic. Emmanuel Giboulou, Bonne, biodynamic. Philippe Pacalet, Bonne, sustainable, organic. Domaine Jean-Claude Rateau, Bonne, biodynamic. Domaine Lafarge, Volnay, biodynamic. Fanny Sabre, Pomard, organic. Domaine Heitz Le Chardet, Cassagne Montrachet, biodynamic. Jean-Marc Rouleau, Merceau, organic. Renaud Boyer, Merceau, organic. Domaine Bernard Van Berg, Merceau, organic. Domaine de Chassornay, Frédéric Cossard, Saint-Romain, biodynamic. Domaine d'Auvenay, Auxy Duresse, biodynamic. Domaine Dominique Derain, Saint-Aubin, biodynamic. Domaine Sextan, Julien Altebert, Saint-Aubin, biodynamic. Maison Humbelier, Pierre Fénal, Saint-Aubin, biodynamic. Domaine Hubert Lamay, Saint-Aubin, sustainable. Domaine des Rouges Coeurs, Marange, biodynamic. Domaine Chevreau, Marange, biodynamic. Domaine Nodin-Ferron, Haute-Côte, organic, sustainable. Burgundy suburbs. Just as New York City isn't limited to Madison Avenue, there's a lot more to Burgundy than the Côte d'Or. Sure, those golden slopes deliver exquisite wine, but there is life and dirt elsewhere, and that's where the creative newcomers are going, as well as the outliers who always worked well. Chablis. Welcome to Burgundy's equivalent of the Upper East Side. Quiet, conservative Chablis has long rested on its past reputation of producing some of the most interesting Chardonnay, stony and mineral, lean, austere, compelling, flinty. In Chablis, the climate is continental and the land is exposed, barely protected from the northern wind. This explains why the best vineyards are southwest-facing, in order to get the last bit of the sun's warmth to help them get to ultimate ripening. Back in 1864, Dr. Jules Guyot described the local vintages this way. Chablis wines have a fine gold color with a green tint. They are strong, although not overly so, and their bouquets charming. They are distinguished by the lively, beneficial, and lucid way they stimulate the mind. But in the past three decades, very few stimulated my mind, forget about the palate. Chablis went through a dark period of trying to have the richness of Merceau and of California Chardonnay. Gone was its charm. On top of that, it has become riddled with commercial plantings and commercial winemaking and commercial viticulture. The total population of organic producers in the region, for the longest time, could be balanced on the head of a pin. But that started to change with one particular couple, Alice and Olivier Dumour. I remember well when I first met them at a wine fair in France. It was in 2007, and the whole room was buzzing about the wines. Stars are born for a good reason, and in this case, it was not only because they were a handsome couple. It is in their hands. I remembered the class of wine, whether it was in their fine Aligoté or their Bel Air Chablis. Much is made of the limestone-based soils of Chablis. You can't spend much time here before you start hearing the words Portlandian and Kimmeridgian thrown around. The Portlandian-based soils are younger and simpler and have less clay. They're basically weathered, harder limestone. They're said to make a fruitier wine, and you'll find most of the rare red wines in the region of Auxerre planted on them. Kimmeridgian marl is royalty. Its outcropping runs from Champagne to Chablis to the Loire, under the Channel, and pops up in England, where they are capitalizing on the famous limestone to make sparkling wine. It has a greater mineral-rich clay and a greater intensity of the undersea beastie shells the region is riddled with. Go into any tasting room or cellar and you'll notice the comma-shaped tiny Exogyra virgula, a type of extinct oyster, and the spiral coils of ammonites the Vigneron has plucked from the earth, all proudly displayed. It is the Kimmeridgian rock that is said to give the wines that legendary flint flavor. In fact, some say if you break off a piece of the comma-shaped fossils, the aroma is that very flint that can come in the wines. Is this just a trumped-up myth? Well, you'll have to see for yourself. But you'll have to find a winemaker who works organically with little or no sulfur and farms on soils riddled with those shells. The names of Ravno and Dovisa are the blue chips in the area. But wines to drink here come from the biodynamic Alice and Olivier, as well as the developing wines of Pat Lou, the organic, and classic from Lillian and Gérard Duplessis. And there's much more to come with Atoné de Beru leading the pack. Haute Côte. This is the catch-all phrase for the vineyard land above the Côte d'Or at higher elevation, with cooler and drier weather, more marl, little subsoil, and less limestone. Here, the future is looking up. This area is like Brooklyn's Bushwick neighborhood, an industrial area that became hot because artists who moved in who needed space and affordability. Haute Côte used to be chock full of chemicals and machine farming, but things are changing in this region that runs along the western edge of the Côte de Nuits and Bonne, with borders touching Nuits-Saint-Georges, Pernod-Vergelès, Saint-Romain, and other communes. There's a lot of clay in spots and a lot of great limestone and clay mix. There are no specifically lauded vineyards. The place was never respected, and to be honest, before the advent of climate change, it was probably too cold to produce good fruit, but that has all changed in the past 15 years. What's more, the new folk here are deep into dirt. Here's a place for value, with plenty of Gamay and Pinot Noir and Aligoté and Chardonnay. Look for Domaine Nodin Ferrade, Domaine Montchauvet, Nicolas Four, Fanny Sabre, and Jean-Claude Rateau.